Hello, guys and gals of Filmland, and welcome back to episode 3 of Misfit Matinee with Blaine and Chris. I am your co-host, Blaine, and with me, as always and forever through shared children, is your co-host, Chris. Hey, Chris, how's your week been?
Hey, Blaine, it's been all right. How about you?
Oh, man, it's been doing pretty good. Just got back from the happiest place on Earth, and I can confirm it indeed is. We had a lot of fun with the whole family and managed to knock out pretty much all of Disney in 4 days, thanks to my brother's ingenuity and navigation skills.
Yeah, that's impressive. So you went to all the parks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went. We started out at Magical Kingdom, went to the Animal Kingdom the day after, which I think is probably maybe my favorite out of the four, and then Epcot and Hollywood Studios. And we got a chance to check out the all the Avatar stuff.
Oh, yeah, they're really pushing that now, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, man. It is the coolest tie-in attraction to the most okayest film I've seen.
Exactly how I would describe it.
Yeah, because, like, I don't know, and if this is boring for you guys, just skip up 2 minutes, but you know, like, how they set up Star Tours? It's like kind of that, like, 3D screen with the moving chairs and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they do that with Avatar on the ride. I think it's called Flights of Pandora. And if those movies were half as cool as that ride, it would be, like, my favorite movie. I mean, it was truly amazing. Like, they take you up, and it really feels like you're flying on one of those little weird dragon thingies that they put their ponytails into. So, yeah, no, that was pretty fun, man. What did you guys get into while we were gone?
Oh, really? Just doing a lot of work, trying to find time after putting Soren to bed to put on something on TV or watch a movie. Really, just kind of same old, same old. We watched a lot of Ozark this week, Robin and I. Which is the new what's his name? Jason Bateman. That's right. Jason Bateman's new show on Netflix, which is actually really good. I really recommend it. And we were able to watch a couple movies, really, it's been kind of a slow week. Glad to have you back. I've been really waiting to talk about RoboCop and the 1987 movies. I'm really excited about this.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely, and I'm glad that we are back. I mean, as you said, Sengo, on this episode, we're going to be talking about a classic movie that just turned 30 this year, a classic action film that helped our generation form into the violent little fucking monsters that we are today. Without saying all that, I'd like to ask you a question real quick, Chris.
Sure, go ahead.
Hey, man, you remember that time RoboCop shot that dude in the dick?
Yeah, you know, when I first saw this movie, and I think I said this in our first episode, when I first saw this movie, I was living in Detroit, oddly enough, and I was 6 years old, and yes, that and the guy with is covered in acid whose skin is starting to drip off and then he gets hit by the car, like, that those two things stuck with me and really popped up in my dreams until I was 30.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's for me, it was one of those, like, formidable films. It's, I think, a lot of our generation, everyone kind of born between 1977 and 1985, this was one of the first, like, R-rated movies that I think a lot of our generation saw, and it was by far one of the most violent R-rated movies of all time. And
even now, it's shockingly violent.
And right.
That scene where in the boardroom at the beginning, where the they do the test, and the executive pulls a gun and then gets blasted out of the window. I mean, that is, and then of course the scene. At the, you know, where the, I mean, everything, actually, the body gore is just all over the place. And it was very shocking at 6 to have stumbled into the room and have seen this movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And before going too much further, in case you live under a rock or you just, I don't know, born in 1998 or something, let's give a quick description of RoboCop. I mean, basically, it's takes place in a dystopic, crime-ridden Detroit. A terminally wounded cop returns to the force as a powerful cyborg, haunted by submerged memories. They make him into a badass robot. He kicks a bunch of ass. we go from there.
That's a good description. That's right. Right. And he learns to kind of find his way back to his identity. And, you know, spoiler alert, he has a family, and that becomes his connection to his humanity that he lost when he became the robot. But yeah, it really is. It really holds up well. You know, Robin and I watched it, and I don't think she had ever really seen it. And she was transfixed the entire time. She just gasped at that board scene, the board where what I was talking about, where the guy just gets blown away. And then everything just keeps on going. I mean, it's really well done.
Oh, absolutely. And this was a great excuse because I hadn't seen the movie in about 10 years. So I've been watching it quite a few times over and over again. And I mean, it's still it's so much fun. It's way smarter than it ever gets credit for. And it really, I mean, it's the future, but not really. I mean, it nails so many things so well. I love all the little interstitial scenes of, you know, marketing and advertising that's on TV. This whole, like, idea of a corporate takeover of, you know, privatized police, privatized, medical systems. It nails the
corporatism out of control, science out of control. I mean, it really is. And, you know, smarter than it gets credit for is really a great description for Verhoeven's entire career and entire opus. I mean, he has so many movies that when they came out were dismissed as being schlock and ended up, growing in esteem over time because of how intelligent they were.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because he's one of those guys. He's always known what he was doing between films like, of course, Starship Troopers, Total Recall.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, Basic Instinct, Showgirls. I mean, he had a heck of a run.
Oh, absolutely. And he's still making good movies to this day. I saw Elle, which was Academy Award nominated last year, a really great rape revenge, great fantasy sort of film that I think only Paul Verhoeven could have gotten away with. He's one of those guys. I truly believe that he is a visionary in film, because you look at Total Recall, you look at RoboCop, Starship Troopers. We kind of live in that future now, at least to some degree, that he was able to kind of take that exaggeration of 80s, corporate wealth and 90s, hoorah America sort of mentality, and kind of combined those two and predicted, at least to a degree, the sort of like commercial climate that we live in.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. He was very prescient and insightful about the way the world was developing, and I don't think we gave him enough credit when he was sending up what actually became our future. And another one that I was checking his IMDb page, and I forgot that he did Hollow Man.
And
that kind of came and went, and I don't think it was very well reviewed, and but I liked that movie. I hadn't seen it in a while, but I remember really enjoying it when it came out.
Oh yeah, I mean, I remember I probably haven't seen that since it was in theaters, but I mean, I remember enjoying it. I remember it being pretty dark. I remember seeing like a weird like clear Kevin Bacon penis. I don't know if I made that up. It's some sort of weird latent thing.
That's right.
But I do remember that. But that's what's great about his movies, from the weirdo sex scene in Showgirls to, of course, the commercials in Starship Troopers. He makes an impression. So whether you like him or hate him, it's almost impossible to walk away from his films without remembering something iconic from each one of those.
Yeah, that's right. And, to get back to RoboCop, there's so many great performances in it that aren't Peter Weller. I really like Miguel Ferrer's Bob Morton, and I think that's how you say his last name, but I'm not sure. Like, he's just fantastic in this movie, and then really became that guy for the rest of the 80s and the 90s for me, popping up in so many different movies. And I think he tragically passed away recently, but he was great in this movie. Ronnie Cox as Dick Jones was great as the bad guy. It came out of nowhere, and it's just a classic.
Oh yeah, and it's so funny because now, and I think for most people, we remember Kurtwood Smith as, you know, the curmudgeonly dad on That 70s Show. But he he's a badass as Clarence Boddicker, you know, as one of the kind of like ground level baddies in the film. I mean, he's so good.
He's legitimately frightening.
Yeah, when he says, "Hey man, can you fly?" and he tosses the guy out the back of the armored truck. I think, man, he is just so good. He delivers those really hammy, kind of like tongue in cheek lines, and makes him so much better. I mean, because that's even when you look at who's just like random guys in the gang. You've got Ray Wise, who I don't think he even has a line in the movie, and still you have so much talent that's kind of being there. And I mean, one person that I love Brian De Palma, but I've never been a fan of Nancy Allen. I don't know, it just doesn't do it for me. I love her in this movie. I love that when they reveal that it's a woman, you think it's going to be your normal 80s kind of like, you know, Stallone movie where it's like she's a woman, but like, you know, she's also like this like sex symbol that's definitely going to be the love interest. No, she's a badass. She's there. She's not ever pigeonholed. And I like that the way they do that introduction, because I really think Paul Verhoeven does not care that she's female and introduces his badass.
That's exactly right. He doesn't use any of the classic tropes to, you know, to characterize her throughout the movie. She's just as tough and just as brave as our hero. Right. And she's going in there with him into these abandoned buildings, 2-on-7. She's a cop in one of the worst situations that a police officer has ever been on TV. I mean, in terms of like a city that's just rampant with criminality and murder and corruption. I mean, and she's just tough. She just can't care less.
No, absolutely. And she's just like doing a job. She comes across, you know, as badass, if not more badass than anyone else in the movie. And yeah, no, I mean, I think you go through the, you know, this entire list, and it makes me wonder if I would have liked Nancy Allen more in those Brian De Palma flicks like Blowout, if he would have used her to what I could tell is more of her full capabilities. So,
and her strength, which is is not as a sex symbol or as a starlet, but as a fully developed character,
like a human being,
believe it or not.
there were very few female actresses used as human beings in the 80s. So,
yeah, that's exactly right.
But I know we kind of touched on, but what are some of your favorite just kind of throwaway scenes throughout the movie?
Oh wow! Well, I really like when he's first coming online, and they keep on, you know, like he comes online is from the diving bell and the butterfly movie, where the whole thing is from you know, his perspective, where he has he's kind of like got paralysis. So he's coming online from his perspective. Everyone's kind of bending down into his view screen and talking. And then he comes online and there's a Christmas party going on in the background. It's just those kind of little details that are thrown in that just make it seem so much more real. And it just made, I don't know, I just remember that. It made me laugh out loud. What about you?
Oh, man, I love it when you've had the big face-off and he's making his way back to the to the boardroom, and just that those final few battles with the Ed 209, which is like this huge, you know, like mechanized, super like mech officer thing. It's a completely
like can't go downstairs. That's right.
They can't go downstairs. And I love that he just shows up and just obliterates. It's like they set it up like this is going to be this great, this great showdown. And he just eliminates him because, yeah, all the stuff with Ed 209 just makes me chuckle because, like you mentioned, you know, not going downstairs. When he faces off with him the first time, all he does is go down steps. And you've got this, you know, this huge, you know, awesome, you know, mech that's chasing him. You're thinking, oh, God, how is he going to escape this? And all he does is go down steps and it falls down these steps. And the whole time that it's fighting and shooting, it makes like this like kind of like cheetah or jaguar, you know, like big cat sound.
Yeah.
And then it falls down the steps and it whimpers like a kid, and I love it. It makes me laugh so hard every single time, and every time I'd buy that for a dollar. I think it's just like.
Now that is it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I forgot all about that, and then I'd buy that for $1 as the TV show in the background throughout the entire movie is just hilarious.
Yeah, because it's like a Benny Hill kind of like Rodney Dangerfield's like sleazeback thing, and he just ends everything with "I'll buy that for $1." I love it.
It reminded me of Idiocracy, where the most popular television show is Ow, My Balls.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it kind of fits in like that same sort of thing. And like at the beginning, when you see the commercial for organ transplants, just to let you know like what kind of world you're living in, where you can like purchase a new organ, but it's all made by Yamaha and Sony, and you can finance it and. I don't know, I just think all that throwaway and all those little details create like a really rich world that you understand and that you get. I mean, and being from Detroit, I mean, when you kind of see it, I mean, how did it feel watching it in Detroit in probably around 1989? Because you saw this on VHS as well, right?
It felt a lot like going to downtown Detroit. did. It's because, back then the Pistons were playing in downtown Detroit and the Tigers were there. And when I was going to all these sports events, we'd be going downtown, and it was as dystopic as as that movie was. It really did not feel like very far in the future for me.
Right. And I mean, now when you look at that old old stadium that's been taken over by the earth, it is just, I mean, I know they like the call all the Detroit stuff poverty porn now, but it's there, that's amazing when you see it.
Oh, it really is. It looks like the movie with Will Smith where he's the last man on earth.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And did you see, by any chance, this is completely off subject, but a good example of kind of that poverty porn, did you see Only Lovers Left Alive? Came out a few years ago with Loki in it.
Oh no, Tom Hiddleston. No,
Man, that movie, they do a lot of that kind of just touring around and looking at weird abandoned areas in Detroit, and that's kind of a fun. It's definitely a little bit poverty porn like, but it gives you a really cool idea of to what degree the abandonment has been in Detroit when they're showing you a lot of these whole shopping malls that have been abandoned for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Before we move on and get into our top five and to our kind of little surprise that's happening today, I have like two more points, questions that I want to ask you, because it just jumped out at me in researching the movie. Wikipedia, the very first sentence in the description of this movie, it calls it cyberpunk.
Right.
Now, this is not anywhere close to cyberpunk, or am I completely insane?
No, I mean, I would not throw it into that category. When I think of cyberpunk, I think of like Blade Runner, Ghost in the Shell, a lot of that early, like Akira, like early anime that was coming over from Japan in the 90s. I don't really think. I mean, I think of this more as satirical action.
Cryptonomicon, right? Yeah, I mean, it's it doesn't seem like there's a lot about cyber in it or punk. It's robotics and it's dystopic, but it's not cyberpunk. So that was one thing. And then the other thing is that one of the big themes in the movie is gentrification. I didn't get that at all. I mean, I did not even see anything about gentrification. It was more about like urban decay.
Right, but the only thing that I could take from that is that, especially once you get into the sequels, you have the whole old Detroit and them trying to create Delta City. Where basically you're leaving the poor and the disenfranchised in this area where they're trying to create this rich and whitewashed area of Delta City. And I really think RoboCop 2 ends up doing a better job of exploring that side of it. I just think that there's so much going on in RoboCop that you could slap a ton of themes to help your search engine.
Right. And it's one of the things that makes it so great is how rich it is textually and thematically, and It really is. It's one of the best.
Right, absolutely. Before we moved on, I wanted to ask you, did you get a chance to watch any of the sequels during this or kind of remember any of them?
I didn't get a chance to watch in our lead up to this podcast, but I have seen them before, but it's been so long that I really can't distinguish them in my mind from each other or from the first one for some reason.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because I got a chance. I watched through two and three. And, I mean, part two, what I do love about it is that it does carry on kind of that satirical side where the whole movie is about how you should not be making another RoboCop. Literally, the story of the movie is how hard it is to create another RoboCop. And, I mean, it's definitely not nearly as good of a film as the first one, but it's kind of fun. Part three is... Oh gosh, it's pretty much abysmal. The only thing interesting on those two films is that Frank Miller did write them. The famed comic book writer and artist.
Oh yeah,
that's so, right. So that's kind of interesting. And then I made it into something that I didn't even know about until recently. In the early 2000s, they did a RoboCop miniseries on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Really?
Yeah, it's basically like four, I think it was 4 hour and a half segments called RoboCop Prime Directives, and oh my gosh.
I have it right here. Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page.
They are abysmal. But the only thing I did like about though is it kind of transitioned to the next thing I want to talk about was it feels like all that weird, like, cartoon and video game marketing that was tied in towards little kids at the release of RoboCop. So it kind of has that cartoony vibe because I don't know about you, but before I ever saw RoboCop, I had like RoboCop toys and all types of shit that were RoboCop that was like marketed towards a 5-year-old at the time of this, you know, basically nearly X-rated action film came out.
Yeah, that probably would have happened to me in terms of the timing had I not wandered into my aunt and uncle watching RoboCop when they were babysitting me when I was 6. And so it, like, definitely I had no idea that this universe even existed, that this character existed. But after that, I certainly had RoboCop toys and a very healthy RoboCop obsession. I love that gun. I got the gun that he used. I thought that was just like the coolest weapon, imaginable. It even took the place of Han Solo's blaster in my imagination as like the number one gun you'd want.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, because that gun could technically like do anything in those movies too. So,
automatic. I mean, just how cool is that?
Yeah, no, it's so awesome. And
automatic. I just loved it. I guess we should probably unveil like our special guest today.
Absolutely, yeah, because this week with our top fives, we wanted to highlight other films from what seems to be one of the best release years of all time, 1987, since these films are turning 30. So we had a special guest. Chris, you want to introduce him?
Yeah, sure. So this is your son and Robin's son and my stepson, Mac. He is 7, about to turn 8 years old next month. And he recently watched Monster Squad again. I believe he's actually seen it several times, starting when he was, I think, about 3. And he was really wanting to do his review of that movie because it's one of his favorites.
Absolutely, yeah, because this is a film that was incredibly formative and important to me when I was his age. So the moment I could show it to him, I did that bad parent thing and just forced it on him, and luckily for me and him, he loved it. So, hey, Mac, why don't you give us your quick review of 1987's Monster Squad?
The Dracula, like, didn't use his power to go through that wall. He used TNT. That's crazy.
Yeah.
He did. He used TNT. That's right.
Like, Dracula don't use TNT usually at that point.
Right. What did you think about the Wolfman getting blown up by TNT put into his belt?
It was so funny, like, his part just blow up, and he, like, got bailed back up. Then right. He got shot in.
Hey, what's the best line of that movie?
When they're, like, the kid, like, say, punch him in the nard. And he, like, punch him, and he said, Wolfman got nard.
Yes. That was a common line between me and my friends when we were your age, where we almost constantly said, Wolfman's got nards.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I may have said that phrase a million times in my young life, because it was just, that's all we said for, like, years.
Right, because that was one of the first times, I think, as kids, we heard other kids talking just like us. It was so cool. And Mac, what did you like about the movie? Or what made it, even though it's an older movie that's 30 years old, made for people, you know, my age and Chris's age and your mom's age, what is it that made you like it now, all these years later?
With the TNT part. Like, blow up part
and all the monsters.
Right, because, I mean, is there anything cooler than having a movie that doesn't have just one monster, not one Frankenstein or one Dracula, having a movie full of everything?
Yeah, it's, like, so cool if you buy everything together.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the Avengers of monster movies.
Uh-huh.
And a really great image rehabilitation for Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah. Because at that point, because I think with my age, I was watching, I'd hit the age where I wanted to see scary movies, so your parents let you watch old Universal flicks. Then by the time I was making my way through those, all of a sudden, there was, like, out of nowhere, a kid's movie that starred all of them. Like, he was like, it melted my mind, because I still love, you know, I believe it's Wolfman Meets Abbott and Costello, where they do a lot of that crossover.
Oh, yeah, but, that's right.
Yeah, but, oh, I love Monster Squad. It's still one of the best.
Yeah, and so, Mac, how do you kill a werewolf?
With a silver bullet.
And kill Dracula?
With a stick or pizza or a sun.
Or the sun, that's right. that's right.
No, that's awesome. Like, hey, can you compare it to anything else that you've seen, from movies that came out for your generation?
Hotel Transylvania.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, those Hotel Transylvania movies owe a lot to Monster Squad. If you had to pick between Monster Squad and Hotel Transylvania, which one you going with, bud?
Monster Squad.
Hell yeah, that's the right answer.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, Mac, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us out with our top five. Hopefully we'll be able to have you back soon, since you do live with all of us. That will be likely. So, hey, buddy, I love you a lot. We'll talk to you later.
Love you a lot, too. Bye.
Bye. All right.
And so did Monster Squad, am I mistaken, or did Monster Squad end up on your top five non-RoboCop 1987 movies?
The only reason it's not is because I know that he wanted to talk about it, and that would give us the chance. So with that in mind, let's get to our top fives. Hey, Chris, you want to kick us off with your number five?
Yeah, sure. So my number five is I saw it at the same time as Monster Squad, and it's really kind of irrevocably linked with that movie as well in my mind, but it's Lost Boys with Corey Haim. I mean, this is at the peak of Corey Haim's powers, of course. And Jason Patrick, who I forgot that he was Michael, I until just recently, because obviously he's had a long and illustrious career as an actor, and I had forgotten that he was in this. And then, of course, Kiefer Sutherland, one of his great Crete guys that he played, it seems like, every movie in the 80s. And then, of course, Corey Feldman. And so it's a Corey and Corey movie. It's just really, to give the audience a little synopsis, it's about this family subsequent to divorce. They move to California into this beachside community. And it's taken over by vampires and basically teenage gangs of vampires. And so it's kind of a high school, I don't even know. How would you describe Lost Boys other than just really fun?
Yeah, I mean, it falls right in the category of what we've been talking about, of like these kind of adult, violent, action horror films made for kids. And it's taken all this kind of great teenage culture, comic books, horror movies, you know, one of the greatest soundtracks of all time between Echo and the Bunnymen and the People Are Strange cover. I mean, it just embodies so much of like that mid to late 80s, like kind of kid culture. And I think that's why even watching it now, it's just like overdose of nostalgia. You know, you see a lot of like that of Dracula AD comics. You know, you see both Coreys really at just their prime. And then, I mean, even when you're going through, you know, the supporting characters, you know, you've got people from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You've got that crazy shirtless dude playing the fucking saxophone. It just oozes with nostalgia and coolness that I don't think I could ever outgrow. I'll think sometimes, oh, I've seen that movie 100 times. I don't want to watch it again. I don't give a shit. Then someone throws it on, and I sit there and just gasp at how great that movie still is to this day.
Yeah, it really is a lot of fun. What was your number five?
My number five is a little movie at the time may have been disappointing, but I think I've grown into over time, and that is 1987's canon classic, Masters of the Universe. Do you remember this movie, Chris?
I do, and I remember the crazy xylophone key or whatever what's it called? I forgot. It's like the pass key. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I believe it's called the pass key. Yeah,
Dolph Lundgren as He-Man. Really, just a great performance by Dolph. It is the role that he was born to play. Other than Ivan Drago.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of those movies. At the time, I loved He-Man. He-Man was kind of my life. You know, I woke up every single morning. I tell this story to Mac, who you heard before, how I'd wake up every single morning at about 5:30 a.m. so I could watch my cartoons in peace. And one of those cartoons was Masters of the Universe as well as The Real Ghostbusters. So when I saw this film the first time, I was just confused. It really has next to nothing outside of just kind of a few of the names and some of the settings as Masters of the Universe, because it really wasn't a Masters of the Universe film. It was this weird time traveling sword and sandal,
like last action hero, where the cartoon element is blended in with modern civilization, and like it's just I will say this about the movie. Skeletor is amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Skeletor is amazing. You have, you know, Sheila, you know, who was foxy as hell then and still to this day, and then just the way that they design, like once you got to the Castle Grayskull parts, It really just kind of, you know, shoots you back to playing with your toys. And you know, looking back on it, that's kind of what the movie was. It was like, hey, we've got this cartoon based on some Mattel toys. What can we do for a modest budget to make people feel like they're playing with their toys? And I think doing that time traveling, I guess like dimension travel kind of thing, kind of works, because then you get to, you know, modern day America, and it's kind of that fun of saying, okay, let's put all of our toys together, see what happens, and make this ridiculous film. And I mean, looking back now with being from Canon Films and, you know, being put together by, of course, you know, Yoram Globus and Menahem Golan, those two, they were kind of great at that, you know, making these ridiculous films. You look back on movies like Missing in Action, you know, of course, the break-in films, all these movies that were cash-ins But they managed to blend them so well that I have so much admiration for that era of films. So, yeah, that was my number five. And, I mean, it's definitely not perfect. But if you haven't seen it since you were a kid, and it's part of that disappointment that also the Transformers movie gave you, revisit it now, and I think you'll enjoy it a lot more than you remember.
It was a little shocking to have He-Man wield like a laser machine gun.
Yeah, it was borderline fucking stupid, but I think now though it's just with that kind of craving of nostalgia that I have, these movies just play so much better now as a 35-year-old man than they did when I was a 5-year-old kid. So I mean, same goes for movies like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. It's like, okay, I love this now. I may not have appreciated it at the time, but now it just shoots me back to that era.
Yeah, that's right. That's another really good callback. I remember being just in love with the first one and deeply confused by the second one.
Yeah, because that's another funny thing to look at. We had touched on this when talking about RoboCop. He-Man was not a show that they eventually developed, toys about. It was a toy that they developed to sell a show, it was a show they developed to sell toys. So, I mean, so when you go back and watch that cartoon, it's not great. It's basically a long-ass commercial. And if you're interested in kind of laughing at those old commercials, I would check out ABCs of Death 2. Some of the guys behind Astron 6, they put together one, which I believe is called Welcome to Zorb or something along those lines, where they do one of the best like callbacks to those He-Man cartoons of kind of like what it would be like if you did go on an adventure with He-Man, and it is deeply disturbing and awesome. But Chris, what was your number four?
So my number four, I really forgot that this came out this year in 1987, but it's Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Classic Coen Brothers movie. Starring Nick Cage and Holly Hunter. It's for those who don't know, it's about this criminal named Hi, and he and Holly Hunter, who's a police officer, decide that they need a baby, and they're going to have to steal a baby from this family that has, I think it's eight or nine. I mean, they just have a ton of newborns, and they're like, well, they're not going to miss any of these, just one. So they sneak into the house. They steal a baby, and then for the rest of the movie, they're on the run with the baby.
That film, I totally missed it on my list, and I was so jealous when you pulled it up, because that is definitely one of the movies. I probably saw it, I don't know, probably around 1995, 1996, early in high school, when I was kind of trying to make my way through like cult films, and it immediately started like almost changing my sense of humor. Because, like, I never seen a comedy like this, that it's, like, this really dark, surreal, story that's also, like, clearly laugh-out-loud kind of funny.
Yeah, Nick Cage is fantastic. I mean, actually, Nick Cage and Holly Hunter both are perfect in this movie. I can't even imagine anyone else playing these roles. And I know that the Coen brothers wrote Holly Hunter's character for her specifically. But Nick Cage was a relative unknown at this stage. I was reading and researching this movie that Kevin Costner tried out for that role of Hi 3 times and was turned down. I mean, it would have been such a different movie with a silly Kevin Costner than a manic Nick Cage.
Oh, you know, absolutely. Because Nick Cage, I mean, I think that's like a lot of that surreal stuff, the bounty hunter. It wouldn't have worked if you had an actor like Kevin Costner. It would have played as like a really straightforward kind of film. And, man, it nails it. And, I mean, my favorite characters are, I believe, what are their names? Evel and Gale, the two buddies that bust out of jail, played by John Goodman. And I'm blanking on the other gentleman's name. But I love... William Forsythe. Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, that's right.
When they bust out of jail, and I love when Ed McDonough, Hi's respectable wife, says, "You mean you busted out of jail?" And he says, no, man, we released ourselves on our own recognizance. And then Forsythe, Goodman chimes in and goes, what Evel is trying to say is that we felt the institution no longer had anything to offer us. And I don't know why that makes me, like, bust out loud, because it's that quick, witty, dry humor that, you know, now we just...
People, we associate with Coen Brothers, really. Yeah, that, like, I just
drool over it, you know. Like, I mean, I love every time, whether it's a movie I love or maybe not as much with the Coen Brothers, I still love getting back to that dialogue, because it's just I love this, like, you know, this kind of, you know, not to diminish and say white trash, but this kind of white trash sensibility that speaks in this, like, eloquently stupid way. I love it. It's one of those things that I think we'll look back, you know, continue to look back and say that films like Raising Arizona, as well as David Lynch's Wild at Heart, both two Nick Cage movies, really scope the way that we look at, you know, genre bending, especially when it comes to, you know, comedy and mixing it in with this bizarre, surreal drama.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you really like this movie too. This is it was probably the first Coen Brothers movie that I saw, believe it or not. I think I saw it real far back. It's probably like early '90s, and it was my first introduction to their sensibility and their, you know, their worldview and the way that they structure these kind of movies to be just slightly off tilt. And I just, from the very first time I saw it, I was like, wow, that is a special movie. That is something completely unique.
No, absolutely. And I believe this was the first one I saw as well, because I still remember it was the same day I rented Raising Arizona and The Bicycle Thief. And I don't know. Wow. Yeah, it was a really good couple picks. They were right next. There, one was on top of the other on the VHS wall. So that's what I grabbed, and I still remember that day because it was such a fucking mind blowing experience for a 14-year-old boy who didn't know shit about anything, watching these two really different and amazing films. Speaking of that, of a guy who rented those two movies in the same day, my number four is the opposite of those. It is a little scene, often talked about film by a gentleman by the name of J. Michael Murrow called Street Trash. It is a incredibly low budget film shot and released in 1987. It takes place in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, where a local liquor store vendor starts selling some cheap 60-year-old hooch that he finds for next to nothing, and all the local hobos start sucking it down. And anyone who ends up drinking it, and it's called Viper, by the way, they end up starting to melt away in a disgusting fashion. At the same time, you've got these two homeless brothers who are trying to find ways to kind of deal with being homeless and make their way throughout the world of this, like, hobo version of Brooklyn. And eventually, you know, have to come face to face with the fact that the entire neighborhood is melting away into monsters. And while this is not, like, the greatest movie of 1987, you know, compared to something like Raising Arizona, I love it just as much. It's one of those films that I found kind of on my own. I had bought a VHS tape of it from a pawn shop, probably like 1997, 1998, and this is at least me using the internet. So with me and my buddies, I was like a god when I showed up with this movie. It was disgusting. It was stupid. It was fun, and the special effects are untouchable to this day. Not only are these guys just melting, and these great prosthetics that are sticky and gooey, every time that they're morphing into these monsters, they're oozing like fluorescent goo, and I just think there's very little like it. And really, I think it does stand out when you do revisit this era and look at the film. It's so creative, it's so colorful, it's got this great punk rock aesthetic. I love films made during this era in New York, so you kind of get to see this pre-Giuliani era that is just such a great setting for a film, and it's full of, you know, just misanthropes, crazed Vietnam vets, you know, these, and then it's right in the middle of it are these two, like, punk rock brothers that are just trying to survive, and it is absolutely untouchable, and I don't know, have you ever had a chance to see this film?
No, I've never seen it, but I was sitting here looking at the IMDb page, and it looks fantastic. It really does. I think I might have to catch this one.
No, absolutely. And what's amazing is J. Michael Murrow, I believe he only directed one film, but when you go through his work as a cinematographer, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, he did a ton of Steadicam work for James Cameron. I mean, he did all the Steadicam work in Terminator 2, True Lies, The Abyss, Titanic. Even went on and won an Academy Award for his work in Dances with Wolves. And then you go through his, his actual films he directed, and it's completely different. But he's definitely one of those guys that has gone on to have a great career, not only as a cinematographer and Steadicam and Unit B director, but also as a kind of one of the great minds of teaching low-budget filmmaking, because when you see Street Trash, it's not like other films of that era. It is truly unique, and I think that there's a lot more to be had, and I think you wouldn't have as much of that ooey-gooey kind of body horror if this guy wasn't just pulling it off as a student. So, yeah, no, I mean, that's a film that might be a little bit more off the radar of what we've been talking about before, but if you love that body horror and that extreme gore that's in RoboCop, you are going to love the shit out of Street Trash.
Yeah, and so that brings me to my next movie from 1987, number 3, which is the movie starring Dennis Quaid and Martin Short and Meg Ryan, Interspace. Have you seen this movie?
I have, man. That was when I was young, and I know everybody, you're gonna get sick of hearing me say back in this day or this year, blah blah, but I'm gonna keep doing it. It's 1987. I was 5 years old, so I remember renting the shit out of this because it was always available. It was PG. It was gross and funny. Dennis Quaid and Martin Short are such an awesome team. Yeah, no, I've only got good stuff to say about it, and I need to rewatch it. I wanted to make it to it, I just didn't have the time.
Dennis Quaid is at the peak of his powers, really, as a leading man. He's got so much charisma. It's just such a cool, like, devil-may-care flyboy. And you're right, being matched up with the nervous train wreck of Martin Short, it's just really funny. And it's still, I mean, it kind of, the comedy really holds up. What doesn't probably hold up is all the close-ups on Martin Short's creepily smiling face. But I mean, the relationship between Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan is believable. Meg Ryan's really good in this, and her flighty best. And then the secondary characters are really what bring this movie together. The cowboy is just a iconic movie character, movie bad guy. It's funny when you go through and you rewatch these things. I had forgotten a large portion of the movie that involved the cowboy, and I as soon as he showed up on the plane and put the cigar out in his hand, I was like, oh my god, that's right, it's the cowboy.
No, he is. I still have good memories of him. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen the film, but yeah, no, I still remember the cowboy, man. That is, because man, this is just prime. Like, you talk about the prime of Dennis Quaid. Dude, this is Joe Dante. He had just gotten done with Gremlins and The Explorers, and he was getting ready to go straight into making The Burbs. This is like peak talent upon peak talent, just playing off their strengths of being strange and funny and playing to like that broad sensibility that Hollywood just has such a hard time hitting these days. Yeah, man, so fucking cool.
It really is. Okay, so what's your next movie?
Oh man, just to make sure we stay dumb, my film is a fantastic send up to Babes in Boats called Hard Ticket to Hawaii. This is made by one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, a gentleman by the name of Andy Sidaris, who basically made a living going, hey, what if we just made awesome action movies full of, you know, blonde bombshells and bikinis, shooting guns, blowing shit up, and just having a good time. And Hard Ticket to Hawaii is probably the most Andy Sidaris film of all of Andy Sidaris's films. It basically takes place in Molokai in Hawaii, and two undercover drug enforcement agents are after a vicious drug kingpin, but on the way, they also have to deal with a contaminated giant python. Yes, it is dumb. It is as dumb as that description I gave you, but it plays so much with what we think of, like, kind of that early 90s, because it kind of set the scope for kind of those early 90s kind of softcore kind of action flicks like you see in the later Emmanuel films that played a lot of times on Cinemax. These were those kinds of movies, but this is by far the best out of all of them, and it's kind of a sequel to another film he had made just a year before, or 2 years before that, named Malibu Express. So it's really fun. You get to these scenes where it's just absolute chaos and mayhem. They're fighting ninjas. They're shooting fire. They're shooting, you know, rocket launchers. They're blowing up shit out of the sky. Women are just taking showers for no reason. It is so much fun. It is incredibly dumb, but I just don't think that you could ever make this film again. He spent a lot of his career trying to kind of recreate this perfection, and never really got a chance. But one thing that might grab you about Andy Sidaris, he was incredibly involved in the early days of NFL, especially with the way that they broadcast it. And he is actually the one who created the cutaway cheerleader shots. He is the one who actually said, hey, before we go to commercial break, why don't we linger on the cheerleaders for a few minutes?
Half-naked women that are dancing on the floor.
Exactly. And that's one thing that's great about Andy Sidaris. Like, there's been kind of takedown pieces put down here and there over the years, trashing the guy. But he, at least in his interviews and in the films he made salacious material that never got beyond being playful and fun. Which I think a lot of that when you do see, you know, those shots of, you know, the half-naked cheerleaders, you know, blowing kisses to the camera, I felt like he played with this era's sexism in a way that never came across cruel, mean, or salacious, and I think you see that in a lot of his films. He may not be some great, you know, feminist mind out there, you know, but I think what sets his films apart from a lot of these other more sexploitation and action flicks of the era is that I never feel like he's just exploiting women for the sake of exploiting women. I feel like he's trying to create something that's fun and playful while still being kind of sexy and silly. So, I mean, Hard Ticket to Hawaii, they play it a lot of times lately on Turner Classic Movies. If you love kind of like Rambo, but also Bikini Car Wash, it's kind of close to combining the two. So it's definitely worth checking out. Have you ever seen any of Andy Sidaris's films?
No, I don't think so. I have seen Bikini Car Wash, though. It was one of those movies that I stuck behind the, one of the covers at Farmore back when the VHS days, where they had like the cover and then you reached behind it to get the actual movie. And so I think I put it behind something like Monsters with Fred Savage and got Bikini Car Wash.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because I'm not sure if you were a fan of USA Up All Night.
Oh, yeah, of course.
This was one of the, like, standards. Like, this and of course, his other film, Savage Beach, they played the hell out of that, of those two movies. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things you can pick up his entire box set of all of his films for about $4.88 on Amazon right now, and you will not be let down. It is a really fun collection a guy's entire life work. And so,
yeah, well, you know, I'll have to look into that too, because again, you know, another movie that I haven't seen, but it sounds really fun. And fun is a great way to describe my next movie, which is The Princess Bride.
Oh my God! Yes, that's 1987 as well.
Yes, so this is a classic that pretty much everyone in our generation has seen, I believe. It's just eminently quotable. There are so many great characters. The story is kind of a swashbuckling adventure, but it's kind of a send up of swashbuckling adventure. And there's it's got Andre the Giant in his by far his best role of his career. As just a really lovable giant, obviously, that is supposedly on the team of the bad guys, but really has a golden heart. Same thing with it has Inigo Montoya, who's a classic quote everyone knows, so I won't even say it. We have Billy Crystal shows up as the magician. What's his name? Miracle Max.
Yeah.
Prince Humperdinck is just such a great, wonderful dick. Like you just hate him, but he's so good at being hateable. The six finger man, which of course is Christopher Guest, it's just a great movie.
No, it absolutely is. That's one of those films that I can't believe it's another one of the movies I overlooked. So when you listen to this, you're like, oh my God, Blaine has the worst taste in movies. I think I just looked at my DVD wall and forgot what great shit came out in 1987, because to me, The Princess Bride, it almost, because it's so well beloved, it falls into that Forrest Gump sort of world where you're like, I just don't want to hear anything else about Princess Bride. But the truth is, it's nearly perfect. I've revisited multiple times throughout my adulthood, and there's nothing bad to say about it. It's fantastic. And if you're one of those people who thinks you're too fucking cool to say that you like The Princess Bride, you're lying. There's no way you don't like it. If you don't like it, please send me a Facebook message. I want to talk about it with you. I want to know what you don't like about this wonderfully smart, amazingly cute, but adventurous film. Oh, man.
It's got everything, including Robin Wright as in her most astonishingly beautiful, just a perfect princess. And someone I had a gigantic crush on when I first saw this movie. I mean, she's gorgeous. She's great in this role. Carrie Elwes as Wesley is just fantastic. Really, this and Men in Tights are the pinnacle of his career for me. It really is. It's a great movie, and I urge everyone, if you haven't seen it in a while, to go back and watch it. It's just got everything that you could want.
It does. There's very little that's not included in that, but the one thing I wanted to mention that I always thought was such a cool device was making it, you know, the grandfather reading the story to the son with, Fred Savage.
Savage,
just a crossover,
that's right,
into your reference before. But as a little kid, because, you know, you're getting into the romantic shit, you're getting to all that, like, it's so great, especially when you are that age, because you have these kind of, these breaks in the story where it cuts back to the grandfather.
Peter Falk.
Yeah, Peter Falk reading the story to the grandson. And it's such a great device to kind of cross it over with, where you're getting, yes, of course, the adults are just enjoying the story. It puts a position for kids to be able to relate. It is so brilliantly constructed. And like I mentioned before, on making these films that are going to appeal to not only kids, not only teenagers, not only adults, being able to combine that into one great film for everyone to enjoy. This era is just knocking it out of the park, because this film wasn't made, it was made for everyone, but it doesn't have that feeling of mass production. It doesn't feel like one of these, you know, limp Hollywood blockbusters. It's got this feel that it feels, no matter what demographic, age, gender, who, whatever you're identifying with, it's for you. There's no one that it's not for. Even if you are a giant, kind-hearted man who drinks, you know, what was that, 300 glasses of wine a day, we've got you covered. It's fantastic. I love it.
And I will, and I do want to point out just how great, and again, this is based on a book by William Goldman, a 1973 novel of the same name. I haven't read the book, but, you know, it sounds delightful. But one of the great strengths about this movie are the names. The names of everything are just so great and so funny and so evocative. You know, you have the Cliffs of Insanity, you have Prince Humperdinck, you have the Rodents of Unusual Size. You know, it goes down the list, and everything is just really, really well done and really funny.
Oh, absolutely. Like, they nail it on all sides. It's I think it's a fantastic little treasure from a year that is just blowing me away. There's too many good movies in 1987.
It really is an amazing year for movies.
Yeah, and speaking of amazing, I want to talk about my number two, which is one of the most influential films in my life. Really kind of changed the scope of what I thought horror was and what I kind of expect horror to be. And that is Clive Barker's untouchable classic, Hellraiser. This is a movie I came across. We're talking about the height of the Freddies and Jasons. You know, I'm expecting another one of these kind of, you know, cat and chase killing teenagers kind of films. I'm expecting to see this a wisecracking pinhead. And what I got was this really mature family drama about love and sex and desire and what it means becoming an adult. And all of this, like, super heavy shit that I didn't even know how to process it when I first saw this film. It was something that was so beyond me that as a kid, I was like, okay, this is a grown-up movie. This is one of the first times that I really said, okay, I don't understand this because I'm not a grown-up, because I'm a kid and I don't know anything outside of, like, poo-poo and pee-pee, you know? And when I saw this film, it just blew me away. And I immediately started looking into more from this guy named Clive Barker that I thought, oh my gosh, this is the biggest weirdo in the world, that they gave some madman a bunch of money to make this film that I don't understand. It makes me feel weird. I love it. I don't know why. And I continue to revisit this film every year around Halloween because it's so multi-layered that I think we could do an 8-part series just on this first film. But if you haven't seen it, it's basically about a husband and wife that have recently been married. The husband has a daughter who becomes our main protagonist, and they're moving into a new family, the family home of the husband. It's clear that his estranged brother had recently been in the home, but he's gone missing. They eventually, as they settle in, he cuts his hand and it bleeds into the house that absorbs it, kind of bringing back to life the brother who's gone missing. Come to find out, he's been out kind of traveling the world, kind of trying to take in all the darkest kind of sexual deviancies he could, and came across a box that promised, you know, kind of ultimate pleasure, which brought about Pinhead and the Cenobites, who, famously say, I will tear your soul apart, you know, and, you know, great lines like, you know, angels to some, demons to others, and they end up destroying his body, and through this blood, it ends up starting to resurrect him in the house, and you learn about this past affair that the wife had with the brother, and she starts basically feeding men to the brother, and it turns into this crazed story of lust, and I there's just so much there. I don't want to ruin it if you haven't seen it, but there's so much there. Chris, I know you've seen this one. What do you think?
I have, and it definitely stuck with me my entire adolescence. It freaked me out, to tell you the truth, in a way that I never really was freaked out by Freddy or by Jason or any of those other movies, and it was because of this idea as hell being this place of just rampant sadomasochistic torture run by these demons, and that they would just drag you down. And that would be, and the whole thing about them coming up with all these like body horror elements and you know, self-inflicted lacerations and pins coming out of their faces and everything, it just freaked me the hell out. And that's what I remember about it. I don't think I really even understood much that was going on. I just remember that I was scared to death.
No, absolutely. And that's what I meant when I watched that first time. I was scared to death at these monsters and this idea of thinking you're going to get what you want, and then, you know, what you wanted is literally hell. That's so scary. It's still a scary idea. And but I just remember all that other stuff was just so over my head. Like, I didn't know it, especially when you look at how sexual that film is and how really even by today's standards, incredibly deviant. It is like, my body and my brain just could not process it one bit. I was like, all I could kept thinking was, I feel weird.
That's right.
Like, it was one of those movies that like, after watching it, I was like, I don't want to watch horror movies anymore. Because this has done something to me that I don't know what it is. And I think those are important kind of films to continue to revisit. Because for me, being a lifelong fan of horror movies, it's almost that high that you're chasing. That, like, of movies that legitimately scared you to death. Well, every time you tried to go to bed as a kid, you couldn't stop thinking about it. It made you feel weird and scared and uncomfortable. It's that high that this is one of those movies that created that I've been chasing for the past 30 years, trying to get that feeling again. So, I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot else to say except that it's nearly perfect. You could revisit it. There's some wonky shit from that era that may not have aged real well, but ignore that. Watch it. And I don't know about you, Chris. How much experience have you had with all the sequels of the Hellraiser series?
I've seen them. I'm pretty sure that I've seen all of them. But this is the one that really just stuck with me. There's so many different indelible images that have been just like really branded on my brain from the very first part where Pinhead comes out and reassembles Frank's face and searching through all the blood and the guts and everything and that the mystery box, the glowing mystery box that gets reassembled and like fixes things and controls the demons and their access to the world. I mean, that was, it just really, there are so many different parts of just this movie that I remember. I don't have a lot of memory of the other ones, to tell you the truth, except that Pinhead was in them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've got a weird soft spot. I know that most of the sequels outside of part two and part four or part five, I believe, Inferno, are pretty much garbage. I still kind of like them though, because I just always hope that I can, you know, kind of get at least some of those great lines and just bizarre torture and shit from those others. But they're not good.
I mean, really, you don't need much more than the first one. It has everything in it. You know, the one of the other things that I just remembered were the chains that attach to the skin and like rip apart that guy. Like that still freaks me out just thinking about it. Like, it just popped into my memory and like it sent chills down my back.
Yeah, because Frank, what does he whisper? Jesus wept.
Jesus wept.
Oh my God, that is like, that's still a haunting, terrifying thing. Like, I've seen Clive Barker talk about it. And he's just like, I just thought it'd be a cool thing to say. And you're like, oh my gosh, like your brain is a whole different level. You know what I mean? And I'm sure eventually, maybe during, I'll try to find a way to tie it in during our October, but not long after this, I ended up seeing another film that blew my mind from him, which is Nightbreed, but I don't want to talk about that too much, because that's another one of those films that like changed how I watched movies and kind of turned me into the little ghoul that I am to this day.
Yeah, and my last movie definitely changed the way I watch movies, in the sense that I watched this religiously over and over and over again, and to where I could probably quote every single line just without even having the movie on. But it's Spaceballs.
Yes.
I mean, it's I feel like this has been like a like an intimate part of my life. Ever since I saw it for the first time, I've been just absolutely. I mean, obviously, I was a big Star Wars fan, still am. But this movie is just so funny, and I mean, from the beginning to the end, it is just stacked with jokes that are just still funny to this day. Like, it's really a well-made, funny movie that holds up.
No, absolutely. And what I and you might not forgive me for this. When I was a kid, Star Wars was like a religion to me. And
oh yeah, me too.
First time I saw Spaceballs, I was mad.
Because
I was so defensive of Star Wars that I, because in my pea-sized, you know, probably at the, when I saw it, when I was probably 6 or 7, I could not understand why anyone could find anything to laugh at in Star Wars. Because I was like,
there's nothing funny about Star Wars.
There's nothing funny. This is what I do all day, every day. Star Wars, you know, like, I mean, I was one of those kids that Star Wars, and to this day, I mean, especially after spending the week, you know, in the Star Wars world of Disney now, it's, when I was younger, I just didn't get the humor. I was just so defensive of my favorite thing in the world that I just couldn't relax. Now, as old, by the time I hit, like, my teen years and realized that I was just a psychopath of a child who is obsessed with Star Wars, it is so funny. It hits the nail on the head. And if I'm not wrong here, so you've got two films that that have Mel Brooks involved in your top two.
yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess I must just be a real big Mel Brooks fan because I that kind of humor has been like just my type since I can remember. I've just always thought his movies are hilarious. This movie is just my favorite Mel Brooks film. And I know there's obviously so many, but this one just stands out. All the performances are perfect. I love Rick Moranis as Dark Helmet. He's just great. It never makes me, every time I watch that scene where they're getting the Mr. Coffee and then they fast forward and they do that kind of who's on first routine about this is now. It's like, when? Now. Well, what happened to then? We passed it. When? Just now. You know, like that is, it's just, it's brilliant. And then, you know, all the supporting characters are really funny. But I love Bill Pullman as Lone Star, and I love Zaphne Zuniga as Princess Vespa. They're just absolutely perfect.
Oh, they're so great. And who I always loved in this movie, and I'm a big fan of his, and I just feel like this movie did such a good job with it, is Dick Van Patten playing King Roland.
Oh, that's right.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, he's perfect.
So good. Yeah, and it's kind of a who's who of, like, that whole era where it's a great combination of, you know, popular comedians of that time, but also from that earlier, that earlier kind of cabaret, that's not the word, but, you know, that earlier era of racy comedy kind of coming together to make
right.
something that's so much fun. Yeah, it's hard not to smile while watching that film.
Well, you know, if you want to get me to laugh, just come up and say Pizza the Hut, and my and my response, of course, would be like, Pizza, you're delicious.
Yeah.
You know, every time. I mean, Joan Rivers is in this as Dot Matrix, the virginity protector, as the virginity alarm. There's even a scene with John Hurt kind of reprising the classic scene in Alien where the monster jumps out of his stomach. But I won't spoil it if you haven't seen it, although I don't know how you haven't seen it yet. But that kind of turns into something really, really funny and delightful. But yeah, it's just I want to give a shout out to John Candy as Barf, the half man, half dog. He's a Mog. And it's kind of an understated, thankless role, but he's just really funny in it. And I encourage, if you haven't seen it in a while, to go back and watch it. I think, it really holds up even now. The humor is just, the setup for the jokes are tremendous. They have Princess Vespa is from the planet Druidia. And the only reason they named it Druidia is so they could have the joke, oh, great, just what we need, a Druish princess. You know, like, there's this, everything is just stocked with one-liners and jokes, and it's really well done, too.
Oh, absolutely, and I can't, I can't tell you how many times my buddies would say, funny, she doesn't look Jewish.
Yeah, that's right. And then, of course, you know, Prince Valium, which is just a great a one-off character that's just it's just really funny, cracks me up every time. The Ludicrous Speed is it's embedded itself in our popular lexicon. There's actually so many different scenes in this that are eminently quotable. So I recommend everyone go out and watch it as soon as possible.
Absolutely. And speaking of movies that we all either have seen or should see, I get to my number one, and it is the classic Cabin in the Woods film, 1987. Of course it is, because we're doing that. Sam Raimi's greatest film he ever made, Evil Dead 2. I'm sure that you've seen this one, Chris, but let's let everyone know. It's basically about Ash, a.k.a. Ashley Williams, who was our hero, kind of, in Evil Dead 1. But he travels out to the secluded cabin in the woods with his girlfriend, where they find a tape recording of a professor and a book of evil. And this unleashes basically a bunch of evil spirits that constantly terrorize Ash. Meanwhile, a journalist comes to the area to study the book of evil. Ash and her end up having to survive a swarm of these demons that are coming up, possessing everyone around them, bringing back, you know, the dead campers from Evil Dead 1, possessing animals, stuffed animals on the walls. And what is great about this film is it takes all that seriousness and that greatness and gore of that first Evil Dead film and decides, hey, let's do it all over again, but this time we're going to do it with a healthy dose of Three Stooges and make the most ludicrous thing that we possibly can imagine. Let's completely throw every horror idea and trope out the window and just make something so silly and fun and over the top that all you'll do is just laugh. And I think this movie, as much as I kind of hate a lot of horror comedies, this film is basically perfect in my opinion. It balances those two really well, because when it's dark, it's dark. It's bloody, it's gory, it's disgusting. It pushes everything a low-budget film should. But at the same time, it's hilarious. And Bruce Campbell is so iconic as Ash. And all the lines, the groovy and all that is just, it never could have been done by anybody else.
I was going to say that Bruce Campbell is, I mean, he's irreplaceable. He's iconic. He's just hilarious. He's in all of the different Evil Dead or, you know, on into Army of Darkness, which I also saw. He's just, I mean, what a great character and what a great run, really, for Bruce Campbell. He's, I was looking at his IMDb page. Like, he's just had just tons and tons of great roles.
Oh, Bruce Campbell is one of the, like, to me, I always think of, like, the great faces of Hollywood, where when you see him, you know it's him. And I love that the way that Sam Raimi, Ted Raimi, Bruce Campbell, and Scott Spiegel, the way that they stuck together, as well as with the Coen brothers, from that same sort of, like, Motor City, low-budget world that those guys all came from. It is absolutely amazing, because they've been together to this day. When you see a Sam Raimi film and all three Spider-Mans, Bruce Campbell's there in some one capacity or another. Ted Raimi is always there. And you look through, older films where they used to do what they call it shimping, where you would basically use the same actors over and over again in scenes and just dress them differently. It's just such an amazing squad of guys that work together to make, to me, some of the most influential films of all time. And I mean, Evil Dead 2, if you haven't seen it, you'll watch it and you'll see that every horror comedy that you've enjoyed, especially Cabin in the Woods, takes from this film, because they're making this horror film in an era where they're creating the rules of the Cabin in the Woods film. They toss all those out the window immediately and call it a sequel, where it's more of a remake than anything else. It's such a strange way to approach a film, and such a fun and original result. Are you a fan of the Sam Raimi?
Yeah, I really am. I'm really a fan of the collaboration with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. All those movies, you know, I watched them religiously. I never stopped laughing, even when it was, you know, even when they're scary. They're just so well done. And I was looking at Ash Williams and the Wikipedia page for Ash Williams, and it was in 2013. Ash Williams was voted by Empire Magazine as the greatest horror movie character of all time.
I agree with that.
Yeah, it's hard to argue against.
Because I mean, could you think of any other actor that could take that role? He is not a good hero. He is technically a sniveling coward,
right?
Who never takes responsibility for his actions. You know, when you see him in the first Evil Dead, he's the last guy you think is going to save the day, because he's kind of a wiener, and he kind of carries that over. And where he goes from being a wiener to a hero in part two, he goes from a hero back to a coward, back to a kind of accidental hero who gets kind of high on his own,
bravado. His own fumes. Yeah,
because. And have you watched any of the new television show, Ash vs. Evil Dead?
No, I haven't. Is it good?
It is so good. I mean, like, it's got some real wonky CGI that's kind of a bummer. But besides that, it is Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness Ash turned up to about 13 for two full seasons. And you get Ted Raimi shows up playing his buddy from high school. It is absolutely so much fun. And big shout out to Ted Raimi. Got a chance to meet him a couple years ago at Days of the Dead in Atlanta. And what a nice guy. Just absolutely down to earth, kind guy who didn't mind talking about all this nerdy shit that we love him for. And he's kind of one of those backbones of these early films where you don't see him, but he's inside every one of those terribly uncomfortable looking prosthetics. Bleeding all over the screen to make us all happy. So big shout out to him as one of the kind of unsung heroes of these Evil Dead films.
Yeah, that's right. And he's Ted Raimi and Sam Raimi, just big shots out. I mean, they had a hell of a run with all of these movies. Yeah, I'm really glad this was on your list, Blaine. I had forgotten about these movies, and I hadn't seen them in a long time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm anxious to go back and rewatch, particularly Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. I think that's what I'm going to be doing next.
I think that should be a pretty good Halloween date.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're in the perfect time of year. That's exactly right.
No, that's awesome. Well, when we get back, we're going to talk about what we got coming up next and our plugs, and we will talk to you soon. Welcome back, and thank you again, everyone, for sticking with us while we talked about these films that are turning 30 this year. Even though we're a lot older than 30, this is the era that kind of molded us, and I'm sure a lot of you listeners as well. We are going to be returning here shortly. We're not going to be leaving you hanging very long, and we're going to be celebrating my favorite month of the year, October, with our first Halloween episode. And Chris, what are we going to talk about?
Yeah, so we're really excited about our next episode. We're going to be discussing the new movie, It. Which we both saw. We actually went together on the Thursday night opening scene, or I guess showing, at the movie complex nearby. We had a great time. We're really excited to kind of go over that with everybody and talk about what we felt about it and whether or not it's good or you should see it. And the short version is, yes, you should see it. It's awesome. And then we're also going to be talking about, after that, our top five Stephen King adaptations, book to TV or book to movie. We're going to have a really good time talking about those as well, because there's been so many, obviously, and there are some astonishingly good ones in there.
Absolutely. No, that's going to be a lot of fun. So if you want to follow us, you can always, go to both our Instagrams and our Twitters. I'm at Mondo_McLaren, and Chris?
Yeah, Blaine.
Your Twitter? handle, sir?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I always forget because I really don't use Twitter, but I do have a Twitter handle. It's KV Sargent, I believe, at KV Sargent. So yeah, you know, if you want to get a hold of me, don't use that. I don't check it. But it's out there just in case I ever get started.
Okay. Awesome. Well, eventually Chris will use that and you can chat with us there, but thank you again for sticking with us and having another episode. If you got any questions or want to add to the conversation, please reach out. We'd love to talk to you. So Chris, take us out.
All right. Yeah. Well, again, this has been a lot of fun, Blaine, and I'm really looking forward to doing this again and talking about it and our Stephen King adaptations.
All right. Talk to you guys later. Have a good day and peace.
Wolfman got nards.